There's something very interesting about Purim that you may be aware of and you may not, and it's really the theme of what I want to talk with you about over the next few minutes, and that is the silence of God, or the apparent silence of God. And with Purim, it takes the form, did you know that in the whole dramatic Purim story, where the life of the Jewish people hangs in the balance, the name of God is not mentioned one time? God is not mentioned at all in the entire book. That's really a very striking thing. And so it kind of suggests to us something about this question that we all at times in life will face to one degree or another as we wonder about the silence of God, or chester panim is what it is in Hebrew. That is the hiddenness of God's face. That's what that means literally. And so I want to explore this with you. You know, it takes this form. To be real personal about it, you know, maybe you've had an illness for a long time, 20 years, let's say, and you wonder, you know, I've been praying about this thing for 20 years, and I'm still not better. Where is God? Has he hidden his face? Maybe he doesn't care about me anymore. Something like that. This is just the human reality. I'm reminded of a song, you know, one that I loved when I was a kid by the Righteous Brothers. You've lost that love and feeling, you know? And you know what I mean? And it's possible for us to have lost that. You've lost that love and feeling. Well, maybe you've lost that love and feeling, you know? You used to be thrilled about God and thrilled about Yeshua, and now it's kind of old hat, and things, disappointments in life have taken a certain turn. And you've kind of subconsciously or at some level thrown a switch, and you wonder, what about the hiddenness of God? Where is he? Or to look more globally and more, perhaps importantly, at the world situation. I remember when Stuart Dowerman and I visited Auschwitz several years ago. How many of you ever been to Auschwitz? Has anyone here ever been to Auschwitz? Okay. Maybe one day we can take a trip to Eastern Europe and then go to Israel. You know, death and resurrection. That would be a very good trip. But it's easy to wonder, how could God let this happen on the global scale? How could God allow something so horrific to occur? And there are answers and things that we can talk about. But in our Parsha this week, we see this same dynamic. We see people who wonder, where is God, and who respond to him in a particular way. And we're going to pick up with the incident of the golden calf. So I'd like to outline the story for you and what happened. And what's striking about the incident of the golden calf, and it's very relevant to what we're talking about, is that these things happened shortly after the miracles of the Sinai experience. We're talking about God showing up in great power, and Moses, the revelation of God being revealed to him, and the people say, all that you've asked us to do, we will do. We will hear and we will obey. And so you would expect that this would begin a chapter of our history that would be filled with terrific things of just doing the right thing and wanting to follow him and victory after victory. But that's not what we find, because while Moses was on the mountain for a period of 40 days, that's a fairly long time, he was up on the mountain, and we read this. I'm not going to read the whole passage. I'm going to summarize some of it for you. But when the people saw, I'm in chapter 32 of the book of Exodus, Shemot. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down the mountain, they gathered around Aaron, the Kohen, and said, come, make us gods who will go before us, for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know whatever happened to him. And the Hebrew is really very clear. It's like they're dissing him. They're just saying, well, who knows what happened to that guy? He hasn't been around in weeks and weeks, and here we are stuck, and we don't know what to do, and we have no leader, and who knows, you know, God, we need gods to lead us forward. And so the impulses of the pagan context of their lives back in Egypt creep back in, and they ask Aaron to make them gods who could lead them forward. Now, of course, we would expect Aaron to say, what are you talking about? Moses is meeting with your God. He's receiving instruction. What are you uptight about? But that's not the way Aaron responds. And so we pick up in verse 2. Aaron answered them, "Take off the gold earrings that are in your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. And he took what was handed to him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a, best translation, young bull, fashioning it with a tool. And then they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Now, of course, you wonder, why does it say "these" when it was just one calf that was made? And the point is that in the ancient Near East, we have a naive view of their religiosity. It's not that they believed that those statues and things literally were their gods. It wasn't quite so simple. There was a close connection, but they really believed that their gods manifested in these objects. But the gods were in some sense transcendent. They weren't utterly naive about that. And so the gods kind of manifest themselves on the platform where this bull would stand. And I think that that's perhaps a more accurate view of their understanding. But still, it's not the God of Israel. This calf represents this idol. And God had just said, don't make any, remember, graven images of me? I mean, it was just, the ink wasn't dry. And here we have them worshiping these things. And so he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to your God." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. And afterward they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in every reverie. Now I should point out there's an interesting ambiguity in the Hebrew text here. When it says, when Aaron saw this, when he saw the people's response, but it could be translated, because the vowel pointings, the little dots and dashes, were not part of the text in those days, and it could be translated, and Aaron feared. In other words, he feared the response of the people, and so he kind of went along with this. But in either case, he certainly did the wrong thing. But perhaps it could be argued he was trying to just gear the people back to God, and so we'll have a festival of the Lord tomorrow. Maybe he... And this is one of the interpretations of the text, that he felt bad about capitulating to their pressure and was trying to steer them back. Okay, then verse 7. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people you brought out of Egypt have become corrupt. They have become quick to turn away from what I have commanded them, made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a young bull. And they bowed down to it and sacrificed to it, and they've said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt.' I have seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they are a stiff-necked people." And here we have the passage that was read earlier, how God says, "Moses, I've had it with these people. Let me make a nation out of you and forget about them. Let's just start over. Let's start flesh. Let's tear it down to build it up. Let's just do that." And Moses, in a role evocative of Yeshua, ultimately intercedes for the people and appeals to God on the basis of God's honor before the Egyptians. If these people get wiped out, then how will the Egyptians feel about all the things that you had done, all the plagues? They'll assume that you're an impotent God and that you don't love your people Israel. So Moses is picking his best argument, and God does relent. The story continues that Moses goes down the mountain and hears what's going on, and he is extremely angry about this. And Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, and his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hands. He just smashed them, a picture of Israel's breaking the covenant. And he took the calf they had made, burned it up, burned it to the ground and turned it into powder and scattered it on the water and made the Israelites drink it. And some have suggested that this drinking of the water with the dust in it is evocative of the very challenging passage about the soteh, the woman who is charged with adultery, and she has to drink water with the print of a text. And if there is an allusion here, it's a pretty partial one. Because in that case, it's not that the woman is guilty. The whole purpose is that she has been charged with something which she may not be guilty of at all. But here, it's clear that
Moses is doing this because the people are guilty. Perhaps what he wanted to do is just put their faces in it or something like that. It's hard to know exactly his motivation, but they drink this. Surely this is no God. You know, they mix it up, they drink it, and this is, he's gone. Aaron says this, "Don't be angry, my Lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' And as for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what had happened to him. So I told them, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it.' Then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." You get that? Okay. Don't blame me. I just threw it. Out came this calf. So you see some denial here. Okay. What we have is, it's a sad moment, and as Dave pointed out, in this passage, in this parsha, this section of the Torah, we have the heights and the depths. Well, this is the depth. And it's occasioned by people saying, "Where is God? Where is he?" Or where is his representative, more accurately. But Moses, who knows what happened to him? We're stuck in the wilderness. We need gods to lead us forward, and, of course, the golden calf. Now, the point here is that God is really never silent, but you have to have the eyes and ears to know his presence. That's the big point I'm trying to make for you today. In other words, he's really never absent, and he's never really silent. His silence, hester panim, the closeness of the turning of his face, if you will, is more apparent than real. So why does God allow us sometimes to think that he's just not there? Well, a big part of the answer is just plain human freedom. And that is, God so values the human experiment, if you will, that he is willing to allow us to invent Auschwitzes, and he will not restrain his hand. One day he will, but he's not obligated himself to restrain himself, or not obligated himself to restrain human evil at every point. What this suggests is the tremendous value he places on humanity and on Israel, but also it suggests the huge responsibility on our shoulders. You know, some people say, "How could there be God? Look at all the wars." And God's saying, "Well, stop making war." You see? And so that surely is part of the answer. But it's not the whole answer, and the whole answer we can't possibly explore today. I'm not sure we could ever fathom the entire answer. Part of it is human freedom, but part of it has to do with how we see things. How we understand about human freedom, as I pointed out, whether we'll allow that to enter the equation or not. And there are other things we can say. For example, when Haman picked lots, remember that? He picks lots. That's suggestive of him perpetuating an ideology that life is just total chance. There is no meaning. There is no ultimate purpose. It's just casting lots. Now, I'm not suggesting that was in some overarching philosophy was in his mind, but we can take a look, think about what happens in the book of Esther, where God seems to be turned, is not present. And as an alternative, he casts lots. Life is meaningless. It is random. There is no system of anything. There is no real God who controls what's happening. It was very interesting. I was with my dad the other day. You know, I've been down there several times to see him. And by the way, thank you for your prayers. He's feeling a lot better. I'm amazed. No oxygen anymore. He's walking around without a walker. He's back to himself. But we were together largely. I mean, he's got the cancer, and you know. But in terms of how it's manifesting, it's he's doing much, much better. And he's not talking about dying immediately. And that's all great. And I was sitting there with him. We're in his garage, and it's in Florida. The door is open. He likes to sit and not outside, but just in the garage. We're sitting around a card table. He's in one chair. I'm in another. And he said, "You know, we have a lot in common. We see things a lot the same way." And I said, "Dad, in some ways that's true. You know, we both like music. We both like football. And there is a real moral, ethical orientation to my dad, which I like to think I have. And there are some things. But I said to him, Dad, honestly, really, we live in different universes in a very profound sense. Not to be argumentative, but I was just making a point. You had to be there. And what I meant was that for my dad, there is no God. Everything is utterly chance. It is random. There is no ultimate purpose, no meaning, and no God to appeal to. And when he was in his, you know, thinking about death, you know, he just assumed that when you die, your brain stops secreting thoughts the way your liver stops secreting bile, and that's it. And you lose conscious existence. And my point was, and he knows what I meant, is I think that's utterly untrue. See, I think that when we pass from this world, we're just passing into another sphere of reality and conscious existence exists. But the big point I'm making is that for him, and he's expressed this, there is no God. I'll quote him. God is what you say to yourself. Let me put it. There is no God. It's what you tell yourself when your kid gets hit by a car. See, that's his philosophy. And we say, no, that's, we say here, no, that's not true. That's just simply not true. It is not a rationalization. It's an issue of having the eyes to see, the ears to hear, having a worldview that can accommodate reality the way reality actually is. And what is that reality? Well, again, it's a big story, but let's boil it down. God is real. God's love is as big as the universe. And Yeshua is real, and by his kippurah, his self-sacrifice, provided for us what we needed most, forgiveness and the promise of life le'olam va'ed. That's pretty basic, and that is a worldview that isn't as prone, if you give yourself to it, to slipping into this kind of spiritual state where God seems to have hid his face, he's not around, you've lost that love and feeling, etc. A lot of it has to do with calling to mind our worldview, and if it's true, then living in it and enjoying it and just sitting in that space, even if temporarily we don't have the same feelings that we might have. Okay. And then there are choices that need to be made when we slip into that kind of space. So maybe you're in that kind of space. Here are the kinds of choices that we need to make. Here are some of them. I'll frame them in terms of questions. Will I spend time with God even though I don't feel like it? It's very important. It's a choice. Will I daven? Will I pray? Or will I just exacerbate this sense of separateness by saying, I'd rather watch TV? Okay, second question. Will I give myself to building community even though my prayers feel hollow right now? That's a biggie. That's a biggie. The only way to maintain the sense of the big wow, I call it the big wow, the sense that God is not hidden his face, he's present, is to be in imperfect but good community and to make it such a priority that that is it, no matter how you feel. Because it's critically important, and I just commend that to you. And the time to make community most important is when you most don't feel like coming and you'd rather watch cartoons on Saturday morning. That's the truth, okay? Here's another one. Will I get the help to deal with the things that I hate about myself? That's a very important question. Sometimes what alienates us from God is not his star panim, not that he's hidden his face, but like Adam in the original garden, we hide our faces and imagine it's him hiding his. You see? And that's a very important point. And the answer here is sympathetic. All of us have stuff about ourselves that we wish was different. I have never met an honest man or an honest woman who would deny that. There's always things that we wish were better, wish were different. Sometimes these things can loom very large in our thinking. The question is, are you willing to get help so as to deal with those things, or do you hide in denial and blame shifting, imagining that if the world were only different, you would not experience what you were experiencing right now. And last, will I get involved in some socially redemptive activity to make the world better in some way? That is helpful in a surprising way. And it speaks to the question of a kind of religious narcissism that we want to avoid, where the whole issue is how you're feeling about your relationship with God. This is a real trap. No, it takes it out of the equation of you and your little world and puts things within a larger context and says, you know, I don't care how I'm feeling, I'm going to do something good for this world. And if we had time, we can talk more about that. Okay, now there are some people who, when they get angry, inflict their spouses and kids with the silent treatment. You know the silent treatment? Don't do that. It's the wrong thing to do. The silent treatment. It's a great sin. And God doesn't do that when he's not entirely thrilled with us. He listened to Moses, and he will be our God even after something like the golden calf incident. He hides his face, actually, we could argue, so that we would pursue him more. And it's very interesting that during the times of the miracles of the Exodus, when God was showing up all over the place, we were our most rebellious. But in the books of history around Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, later on, where God's supernatural presence is much less, we find people going to the wall for him, and they're much more obedient. Very interesting. So think about that, that he sometimes he hides his face, or seems to, so that we will be drawn closer to him. It's all about choice. So let's pursue him together. His silence is only apparent. Ki le'olam chasdo, his loving kindness is forever. Shabbat shalom, everyone.